The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Back in 1998, I did my only interview with a gentleman named Chris Mazur. We talked on the telephone. He was in Corvallis, Oregon, and he had a book out called Vision and Leadership in Sustainable Development. And I realized that this is a very dry-sounding title and subject, but don't let that put you off. This is a great thinker and a really great book, and he's an expert in sustainable development. And I Googled him because I was curious to know, when we did this interview, he was in his 60s, and I wondered what he's up to these days. And I saw that since he was on the show in 1998, 27 years ago, he has published 30 more books. He is now 87. He put out a couple more books last year, and I would guess he's probably working on another. Let's listen now as we visit with Chris Mazur on the Best of the Book Nook back in 1998 for a book that I think really holds true to things that we're thinking about now and issues that we're dealing with today, if not more so than 27 years ago.
I was trained as a zoologist. I always loved animals. From the time I was four, I knew what I was going to do, and I loved science. And for over a quarter of a century, I had an absolute love affair with science, primarily in natural history and ecology, which was the broadest thing I could find. But during that time, I also found that society is asking questions of science and scientists that science is not designed to answer. Those are questions of value. Science is designed to answer biophysical questions about biophysical relationships, to satisfy our curiosity about how the world works and why. But that precludes human values, which are a mindset or a worldview. So I got out of active research about a decade ago to struggle with a question I have struggled with for over 30, 40 years, and that is, what is sustainable? What is sustainability? And I've been working with that ever since. And my intent is to help society understand the role science can play in sustainability for communities by helping them to understand the possible ecological consequences of their decisions when the proper question is asked. On the other hand, politicians and leaders and staffers in agencies have to understand that they must mature psychologically enough to accept the adult responsibility of dealing with the social issues and values. And we haven't achieved that yet. But if we are going to be sustainable in a sustainable landscape, we must achieve psychological maturity and then stop using science as a baseball bat in politics and use it for the way it is designed to be used.
And to accomplish this, the globalization that's going on is a negative, isn't it?
It is. In fact, I got together with a very bright economist, and we have a book coming out next year on reuniting ecology and economy and sustainable development, and looking at what is happening through globalization as it steals the heart of community, and it makes each community into an economic colony for the mega corporations.
I was reminded of Star Trek when I started your book, because you begin it with your concept of the prime directive. Explain.
As I've dealt with science over the years, I have found there are a few basic things that humanity must do in order to survive, things which are inviolate. We must, for example, have clean air, because air pollutes the entire world from the highest mountain to the deepest ocean, because snow and water scrub the pollution out of the air and it goes through the soil and gravity takes it all downhill. Streams can be flushed of toxins the ocean cannot. It has no outlet, so everything concentrates. And the oceans belong to everybody in the world. They don't belong to us. So while we can have a flushable river, we cannot have a flushable ocean. So clean air is absolutely critical. There are pesticides that were released in the tropics 60 years ago showing up in the bark of trees at Arctic tree line in North America today. Clean water, clean soil, healthy soil. These are things that we human beings simply cannot live without because we depend on the diversity of the plants and animals to produce the raw materials that we use in our livelihood and for the viability of our economic base, and all of them depend on clean air, clean soil, clean water, and a relatively stable climate, which we are also working very hard these days to destabilize. So the Prime Directive is saying basically, if we are going to be tenants of this world, looking at it more on the cosmopolitan sense, if we are going to be global citizens, what must we do? What must we pass forward? And one of the reasons that I came up with this was I've spent time asking children what they want their future to be like, a question parents almost never ask, or teachers for that matter. What do you children want us as the trustees of this living trust called the world to leave for you? You'd be amazed at their answer. They have far greater wisdom in their uncomplicated way of thinking than we do with all of our gadgets. And they were the basis of the Prime Directive. When we get into the human issue of right versus wrong, children don't play that game. As I've traveled in the world, I have more than once seen one of my favorite scenes in an airport. It's to see a little black or brown or yellow child and a little white child or black and brown and yellow recognize the child in the other and run up and hug and kiss. The parents get terribly uncomfortable. But here are these two little kids unabashedly hugging and kissing each other because they recognize in one another the thing we too often forget. They recognize original innocence. There is nothing there but love. That is what we lose. We also have our imagination stolen in the schooling systems. And that is one of the tragedies. You see, to a child, everything is possible. And I would ask you to consider that going to the moon was physically impossible until somebody asked the question, is it possible to go to the moon? In that instant, it became a possibility, though we didn't know how to do it. But until that question is asked, it isn't possible. The moment that question is asked, how do you know it isn't until you try? And that's the beginner's mind. That's the child's mind. The Zen Buddhists look at it as a beginner's mind, a mind unfettered by the knowing of how things should be, that is open and free to explore how things might be, which has brought me to the point of looking at my ignorance as my greatest sacred space, one of my greatest joys. Out of my ignorance comes all of the wonder, spirituality, and come the best questions I am capable of asking. So I choose my ignorance carefully. I'm ignorant about being a doctor. I'm ignorant about being a lawyer. I'm ignorant about fixing a fax machine. But I know there are other people out there who know how to do those things. So I can revel in my ignorance and thoroughly enjoy my expertise and not see my ignorance as something I have to get rid of, but as a companion that gives me the wonder and mystery in life. That's the child's mind. That is the beauty of being a child.
And the essence of our survival, of our sustaining our environment, is the gift that we have together.
That is not only the gift we have together. We must keep one thing in mind, again, getting back to children, since they're the core of everything we do in the end. We only have four things to give our children, and it's the same four things, Vic, that I have to give you or my wife. And that's my love, my trust, my respect, and the benefit of my experience. I have nothing else of value. What we give our children, therefore, are choices and some things of value from which to choose. And in every choice we save and pass forward to a child, to the next generation, which is what sustainability really is passing forward choices and some things of value from which to choose. With every choice we pass forward our love, our trust, our respect, and the benefit of our experience. And with every choice we foreclose, we withhold those same four things. That is why planning and having a vision in dealing with community development is so critically important. Because a vision, to deal with a vision, to craft a vision, is the heart and soul of democracy. That is how people empower themselves to come together. And rather, you can't stop something. You can't move away from a negative. If you say, Johnny, don't go in the street. Johnny, here's go in street. Don't doesn't compute because it's an oxymoron with go. What the parent needed to say and wanted to say was, Johnny, stay in the yard. Well, that's what the vision does. The vision puts the positive in the positive. And in so doing, we're trading freedoms. Everything is defined by its relationship to everything else. Nothing is totally free. Therefore, if we get together and build towards a positive future, what we are saying as human beings is, look, I am willing to give up some of my personal freedom in order to have this greater freedom as a community. And every community member says the same thing. So we trade freedoms, and in that trade, we empower ourselves. Now, the crux is there has to be one non-negotiable constraint, open space, for example. Open space is the most limiting thing in and around a community that constitutes the quality of life. Every decision that is made must be measured against maintaining or enhancing the quality and the quantity of that open space, if the vision is to work. That is then the unconditional gift that we pass forward to the children by having the courage to become the government, to become responsible citizens, and to accept that responsibility. The crux I find in everything, the problem is that the elected politicians and the staffers in a lot of the communities don't know how or want to share power, so the visions are never implemented. And that then becomes a breach in the democratic process by those very people who are constituted as the leaders. This is why, in the end, I think the communities are going to have to lead themselves collectively, because too few people are mature enough to know how to step down. I find our government too big to deal with the small problems of the individual communities and too small in bipartisan spirit to deal with the big problems. So I think the communities are going to have to start taking responsibility for themselves and one another in an area and do it collectively so everybody comes out with their dignity intact.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back to 1998, my only interview with Chris Mazur for his book, Vision and Leadership in Sustainable Development. And it's really all about community. And you're listening to 91.3 WYSO, connecting our community through news, music, and storytelling on the air and online. We'll continue with this archival interview right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back to 1998, an interview I did with Chris Mazur for his book Vision and Leadership in Sustainable Development, his only interview on the program, and I was so pleased when I played this back because it's a good one.
You give some examples of leadership, some historical figures in the book, going back a couple of thousand years, Spartacus, and more recently Mahatma Gandhi. These are very different types of leaders, but you indicate why their leadership was done in a good way.
Yes. With Spartacus saw something, I don't know, if you folks listening have not seen the movie, I recommend it highly. It's an excellent movie, and it shows one basic tenet of leadership that we desperately need in the world today. Spartacus was a Greek slave. captured by the sold to the Romans and was to be trained as a gladiator. And there was a riot in the gladiator school, and all the gladiators became free. And they started robbing and looting the Romans. They were acting like the Romans. And Spartacus couldn't stand this. So he confronted them and, in essence, said, look, you have become in your behavior what you are against. Now, I see this all the time. The environmentalists become the industrialists. The industrialists become the environmentalists. Anytime you lie, cheat, and steal about data and act like your opponent, you become that opponent. But he saw something else. And that this is the crux of the issue. He told them, look, we have to be higher than the Romans. What he was saying is that the level of consciousness that creates a problem in the first place is not the level of consciousness that can fix that problem. That we must step up a level of consciousness. We must recognize that we can't afford to become the Romans. We must have a better level of consciousness in order to fix the problem. So he did two things. He organized the slaves into an army based on two basic principles. We will not become what we're against. We will remain better than that. We will focus on the principle and not on the emotion. And two, we will treat people better than we are treated, which is going up that next level of consciousness. What Spartacus represented was the principle, and that's exactly what Gandhi represented. Gandhi represented the principle of nonviolence. The principle is peaceful non-cooperation with something which was evil in behavior. But both of them did something else. They separated the person from the act. They did not condemn, Gandhi never condemned the British. He condemned their behavior. Spartacus did not condemn the Romans. He condemned their behavior. And the greatest condemnation of the behavior was not to become like them, but to be better. Those are the great tests, and those are the great lessons. They're simple, but they're not easy, because you've got to be willing to risk, and that is something few people are.
You say, I have met a few people with much wisdom and little knowledge. I have met many people with much knowledge and little wisdom. And you talk about the qualities of leaders.
But yes, the qualities of leaders, this is an interesting thing. Leadership can be learned. The skills of leadership can be learned to some extent, but I don't think a leader can really be trained. A leader needs to be nurtured, because a leader has to have within an image of something that is possible, an image of something that is so compelling, so exciting, so valuable that he or she is willing to risk even death to fulfill it. Now, you don't have to do that in sustainable community. At least I haven't seen that happen yet. But the point is that the death the leader has to be willing to accept all the time is change. We become encrusted in our way of thinking, and a leader has to be willing, like a crab, to break that shell, to break that incrustation and get out and grow personally. And if you have ever, in Ohio, you probably don't have crabs. But there are other insects that you've probably all seen at one time or another. A chrysalis or a cocoon breaks open and a butterfly comes out. When that butterfly first comes out, when it goes from the worm to the butterfly, it's vulnerable. It is soft. Its body parts have not hardened, because insects' skeleton is on the outside of the body, unlike ours, which is on the inside. They harden, and to grow, that skeleton must split again, and the insect must come out, and it's soft and vulnerable. But it can only grow when it is vulnerable. We are the same. A leader is willing to grow, to risk change, to die to the old belief system and constantly take on something which is renewing and newing, and willing to stretch, because when we are the most uncomfortable, that's when we grow. However, followers generally are not. that willing. So the leader must do two things, must be willing to accept the fear in terms of criticism, but to be a good leader, one must first be a good follower to find out what you are asking your followers to do and how it feels. And there's, a movie that is very good in this. It's called The Doctor with William Hurt. William Hurt was a rather cavalier, flamboyant surgeon. And they played music in the surgery and cracked jokes until he got cancer and became a patient in his own hospital and found out what it was like to be treated as a patient. The upshot of the movie was that when he became well again, he made all the interns that worked under him become patients for a month so they would understand how the patient under their care as the doctor or leader would feel. This is a critical concept because we need one another. Human beings are creatures who must share to know that we exist and have value. We must be heard. That being the case, if you think about it, nothing is entirely free. Everything is bounded by its relationship to everything else. So if you garner all the material wealth unto yourself that you can possibly get, but you lose sight of someone to share it with, you'll find you have nothing of value after all. For example, let's suppose you have a favorite place out in the countryside or a favorite theater. And I give it to you. I'm king of the world. I give it to you. You own the whole thing, and it's in perfect condition. The caveat is you're the last person in the world. What value would it have? What value would it have if there's one other person to share it with? A leader is the one who helps people overcome their fear so there can be a collective sharing. That's why a leader is so important, to be willing to step beyond the self to help a community with a vision, even if it isn't what that individual person who leads would like to see. The majority rules. A leader helps the majority to make wise decisions.
So the leader cannot be self-centered. The leader must be other-centered.
The leader must be other-centered, yes. And there's a way of looking at this which is interesting. Think of love versus fear. Let's suppose for a moment there are just those two emotions in the world, and anger is a kind of fear. And there are two birds. And each bird, they're large birds like an eagle, and each one has a circular nest of sticks. The bird on the left is afraid that somebody will steal the sticks of its nest. So it sits on the nest and clutches it. That's fear. The bird on the right is unafraid. It's other-centered. It reasons, well, if somebody steals one stick, I'll bring back two or three. So it leaves the nest and it risks getting out to collect more sticks. That is the difference. The leader is the bird that risks. It is not the bird that clutches. I have on my desk a carving of a turtle, a wooden carving sent to me by a lady from Mexico. That turtle is my totem. It reminds me of what leadership is. Again, fear versus love. The turtle, every turtle, has two choices in life: to suck its head into its shell and starve to death in safety, or stick its neck out and risk finding something to eat. The leader will risk. The follower often sucks in. So the leader must eat the inner food, the guidance for the whole group, and help them gradually feel safe enough to stick their own necks out. What a leader really does is help another person find their own potential. A leader midwives the other person's fears into courage so they can step beyond where they have ever been. But the leader does not take credit for it. When the task is accomplished, a good leader disappears because the other people say, we did this ourselves. They take ownership in it, and therefore they are committed to seeing it through. A leader does not need to have the praise. A good leader simply needs to lead.
And you point out that leadership involves two kinds of authority, and one kind of authority is about the position, the other is about the person and the spirituality of that person.
Yes. The inner authority is that drive, that inner light, and that the person who is the leader sees what needs to be done and how to do it, sees what is right to do. Now, we often put people in a position of authority, like the head of a, well, I used to work for an agency called the Bureau of Land Management. And I heard people talk about the directorate, but nobody knew who was in the chair last.
Huh.
The point is, they were awed by the position.
Uh-huh.
But I saw no competent people sit in that position. On the other hand, my supervisor down on the ground was a first-class leader. He didn't sit in that position of authority in Washington. He had a far lesser position. But people listened to him because when he spoke, he had an inner authority, and he knew, they knew that he cared about them. That's what makes a good general or a good leader in the military. A soldier will follow any leader that they trust to be willing to go where they are asking their soldiers to go. If it's going into the firefight, the general goes in first. A soldier will follow that person to hell and back. And that is what it really takes. It takes that willingness to have the inner authority. And what happens is when the people believe in that, believe in the person, they validate that authority. But a position of power, social power in a political sense, is hollow unless a leader sits in the chair. Anybody can sit in the chair. But if a leader sits in the chair, then the whole position becomes electric. And that is what makes the difference.
My guest is Chris Macer. His book is Vision and Leadership in Sustainable Development. I have seen a lot of leaders in my time, and the thing that I've noticed, the good ones trust other people. They are willing to delegate their authority to others and have good people working for them.
What they're really doing isn't delegating authority, they're sharing power. That's the critical part, and you're absolutely correct, Vic. I could be president of the United States, and I'm totally incompetent at being president of the United States, but I could be president of the United States and be good if I had a few qualities. One was I was honest. Two, I really cared. Three, I was willing to accept other people's fear and criticism. And four, I picked good people for counsel. I listened to them, and I shared my power with them, while taking responsibility ultimately for the decisions. I can do that. I don't have to be a whiz kid. What I have to have are those basic qualities. Sharing power allows everybody else, when you think about it, to magnify the president or the leader as the leader in turn magnifies the other person. It becomes a self-reinforcing feedback loop that works in everyone's favor. But the other part of it, and this is a critical part, I was just reading in the paper this morning that President Boris Yeltsin is sick, high blood pressure, etc.
Uh-huh.
My question would be, and what I've observed in people who are in positions of leadership but are not leaders in the true sense, they don't know when to step down. They don't have it within them to give up the power because that is what drives them. It isn't the service. A leader is driven by service. Somebody who is in love with a position is driven by the sense of power. It takes a psychologically mature person to know when to step down and let a younger person take over. When to give up the reins and say, I have done the best I can do. Now it is time for a fresh mind and a fresh heart to take the helm and walk away and become just a person again. And President Truman did that. He's an excellent example. A woman had an interview with him and took her son to see President Truman after he was president. And as they're driving away, the little boy was in tears. And his mother asked him why. He said, I wanted to see the president. And she said, you did. You talked to President Truman.
Uh-huh.
But he has given up being president and is now just the man he was before he became president. That is leadership.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. And I loved what he had to say about leadership back in 1998 and how it's important for leaders to care about the people that they're leading, about the community that they're leading. I can't imagine a leader who disparages his followers, but I don't need to imagine it. We have a leader who described some of his constituents as garbage this week. It makes me very sad. We'll continue with the Best of the Book Nook right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Going back to my only interview with Chris Mazur, recorded back in 1998 for his book Vision and Leadership in Sustainable Development.
As I look at the landscape, and it looks like a war zone, what I'm seeing is society's mirror, and what I see mirrored in that vision of clear-cut forest or overgrazed rangelands or polluted oceans is our social mirror. It is a reflection of how we treat ourselves and one another as human beings. As long as we compete out of fear, compete out of avarice, we can only destroy the landscape because that's where we compete. When we learn to live with love, trust, and respect, when we learn to cooperate and coordinate, we can only heal the world. We will have no other alternative because we are healing ourselves. Carl Jung, the Swiss psychiatrist, was once asked if there was any hope for humanity, and he said, yes, as long as enough people do their inner work. That's what it takes. We are facing a spiritual crisis. And until we are willing to heal ourselves and treat one another with love and respect, we're headed down a course which I do not see changing. We have to change before inside, before anything will change out there. We do not have environmental problems. We have problems of thinking which manifest in the environment. The problem isn't out there, it's within us.
And we have created a monetary system which has imprisoned us.
Well, more than that. One of the reasons I started dealing with environmental conflicts was because I recognized there are two silent voices. One is the land's productive capacity and the other is the children. We live in a democracy. In my experience, the freest democracy in the world. And a democracy is sloppy. And it's expensive. And it's tough love. You really have to want to. You really have to want a democracy because it's demanding. It's demanding of our growth. But a democracy is based on the principle of taxation with representation. If the outcome of any decision, if the outcome of any conflict is a deficit in the land's productive capacity, that steals choices from the children. That runs counter to everything a democracy stands for. That's one thing. The other thing is we are committing the children to pay an awful price that we don't want to pay. We keep passing it forward to the next generation. And that brings up something that I've noticed as I've read about different religions or been in different churches in different countries. Every religion I've come across says, in essence, thou shalt not steal from thy neighbor. Now the question becomes, who is my neighbor? The religions talk about neighbors in space, you living across the street or next door. But they never, except for the indigenous cultures, they do not talk about neighbors in time, which is the children. And our economic system not only condones, it encourages stealing from the children by devaluing any renewable natural resource saved and projected into the future. These things have got to change. And this strikes at the very heart of the right to private property. And I think that's going to be the issue in the debate of the next century. And the question is, does a human being have the moral and legal right to degrade the productive capacity of a piece of land of which we can only be trustees, to degrade that and steal the choices from the next person, the next generation who must live there? Or do there have to be some legal, ecologically sound limits put onto what people can do with the property to ensure that those options are passed forward? Edmund Burke, the British statesman and philosopher, once said, in essence, that I'll paraphrase it because I don't remember the exact quote, but that it is ordained in the nature of things that all people who do not have the ability to curb their appetites on the inside must have regulations to curb them on the outside, that their very passions forge their fetters. Therefore, no one is completely free.
You grew up very concerned about clear cutting, about the timber industry, about the decline of the virgin forest, and you kept getting more and more distraught about it. And I think you were giving a speech at one time and something happened to you.
Yes, a couple of things. First, I was angry. I was like a lot of people, well, the people who burned the buildings in Vail, Colorado. I had that kind of rage because everything that I loved growing up, I saw cut down or destroyed somehow. And I was giving a speech, an impassionate speech about old growth, maintaining old growth. And it wasn't so much what I said, but it was my attitude. As Emerson said, your attitude thunders so loudly I can't hear what you say. My rage came out, and I remember one gentleman got up and he walked out and he looked at me as he walked out and said, "You arrogant son of a bitch." And he was right. I was so enraged. I was so terrified. I felt so helpless that I blew it. I made 200 people mad in 5 minutes, and they might have listened. And what I learned from that after a while was that they didn't have to change. I had to change. But there was something else. I was giving a talk to 60 loggers some years ago, and in there about sustainable forestry and doing things better and why they had to have different practices. And when I was done, and I'm 60 now, I just turned 60. This guy was in about 60, but to me, I was in my very early 40s. He was old.
Uh-huh.
And he came up to me, had twinkling blue eyes and snowy hair, and he said, "Sonny,
you don't know.
Blank. You have a good point there, I'm sure, but I just can't find it. Mostly, you just don't make any sense."
Uh-huh.
And I said, "Well, what do you mean, sir?" And he said, "Well, the way I think of a forest, you just don't make no sense no how." And you know, he was right. What I learned from him was invaluable, that you cannot change practices or concrete things until first you change the philosophical underpinning. Everything, I'm told often, "Mason, you're just too philosophical. You're shooting for utopia." Well, utopia is the only thing that's worth writing about, one, or striving for, and two, the most concrete, greedy, environmentalist, industrialist, whoever, still has a philosophical underpinning. Everything does. And until we change those things, nothing else is going to change. But that means we have to change ourselves. It always gets back to us. It's not out there somewhere. It's within us.
Well, Chris, I read a lot of books to prepare for this program, and it's very rare that I read a book that I wish I could somehow require others to read. I know that seems like a really totalitarian thing, but there's just so much in this book. The book is Vision and Leadership in Sustainable Development by Chris Macer. And at the end, when you have coping with the responsibilities and pressures of leadership, so much good advice in this section. I wish a lot of aspiring readers would, or leaders would, read this.
I don't remember everything that's in there because I've written two books since. I'm sorry. But I would hope it does not come across as advice. I've learned in working overseas that no one has the moral right to give advice to anyone else. I can give counsel. Francis Bacon said it best. If you give advice, you build with one hand. If you give good counsel, you build with both. For me to give someone advice, I'm telling them what I think is good for me. That doesn't make it good for them. If I can give them counsel, which is the benefit of my experience, then I allow them to choose what works for them. And that, in the end, allows each person to be the caretaker and the owner of his or her own conscience, but it also makes them responsible for the outcome.
Well, I will try to choose my words more carefully. Carolyn Mace clearly is someone who you think gives good counsel. She talks about the use of power, and she says, from the time we are young, we test ourselves in our capacity to learn what and who has power, to attract power, and to use power. And then you say that if we decide that we cannot attract power, we begin living in a type of power debt. This was a new concept to me.
Mm-hmm. Power debt, the notion of no power is something which, to me, leads a lot to depression. It leads to not being heard, and it also leads to violence. That's one of the things that I have seen over and over. And I grew up in a dysfunctional family. I have a pretty good idea of what it's like to feel powerless and feel that rage and then want to strike out. In one sense, it's saying, hey, I'm here. Pay some attention to me. But in another sense, I'm not sure that we're talking about exactly the same thing in my mode of thinking at the moment, because, as I said, I haven't read my own book recently. But the thing that is, when someone feels a lack of power, it's like a dog that gets hit by a car, and when the owner comes to help, bites the hand of the person who has raised it. It's simply a random, in a sense, striking out in fear at the world. And I did that growing up. I struck out at the world. And I expected somehow that the world would strike back, but it didn't. And I had no way of feeling empowered. I thought it had to come from outside. And I found that it has to come from within. Years ago, when I was working in Egypt, I came upon an old cistern well built by the Romans. And I used to climb down in them because I was catching cobras, and there was the safest place to get them. They know where to hide when they fill in, so I could see them. But one day, just on one of these little inner promptings, I poured some water from my canteen down into the well and watched it sink into the sand. And it occurred to me, and it has been reinforced over the years, that a well can only be filled from the bottom. That means we can only be empowered from within. There is no such thing as job security outside of ourselves. There is only the security, the spiritual security from within. So what we do when we look for power, when we grab for power, when we go through our gyrations of consumerism, we're trying desperately to fill up empty spiritual wells from the top. And you can pour all the water, all the material things in from the top you want, and they'll sink into the sand. You've got to be filled from within. And if you're filled from within, you will have the inner power and have no need for the outer. If you do not have that inner spiritual fulfillment, you will grab for the outer power, and you will never have any inside.
You also state that criticism is a form of projection.
Yes. Criticism is an outward thrusting of fear. And I have observed, because I've dealt with a lot of criticism in my life, especially in the area of forestry, which I've also delved over the years, I've noticed something around the different countries I've been in, especially where there are a lot of statues. Every statue is raised as someone who has been criticized. I've never seen a statue raised to a critic. A critic is somebody who is willing to snipe. It's easier to edit than it is to write. It's easier to criticize than it is to do. Now, I'm not knocking editors in any way, but I edit too. And I know that editing is easier because I am not doing the creating initially. Anyone who is going to do anything in life is going to be criticized by someone who is frightened by the thought or the action or whatever it is. And what one must realize is that if you do anything of value, anything which is new and different, anything beyond what Carolyn Mace calls the tribal level, you will be criticized. Now, you can either see that as a negative or take it as a compliment that you have had the courage to risk. And I've learned the best lessons from my critics. When I send a book out to be reviewed, the person who disagrees with me the most and is the most nitpicking always causes me to rethink, to re-envision, to test my thinking, to test what I'm saying and how I say it, because I can't hear myself. That is the person that does me the greatest good, but I have to be willing to accept that without being afraid and without being put on the defensive by it.
Well, Chris,
I have to ask for it.
I'm looking at the clock, and I see that we've really gone through our time here. I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the program. The book is Vision and Leadership and Sustainable Development. I have just one more question. You dedicated the book to Princess Diana. Why did you choose her?
I chose Princess Diana because when you look at her life, she was thrust on the world stage at an incredibly young age with basically no preparation. I don't care what kind of family you come from, you cannot be prepared for the type of criticism and jealousy and responsibilities you will be given. She lived those in front of all people. She struggled with them openly. She became, in essence, a leader. Not that she was leading a great nation, but she dared to live her truth. I tried to define truth once, and in a dream came to understand that truth is not definable. It is something that we must each live in our own actions. She did that. Now, you can criticize her, love her, or hate her. It doesn't make any difference. She had the courage to keep her own scorecard against tremendous odds, and that's something I have to admire. That is why I dedicated the book to her.
You've been listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, an interview I did 27 years ago with a guy named Chris Mazur. My only interview with him, and over the last 28 years, he's published 30 more books. Look him up. He's an amazing writer. And what a flash from the past, talking to him about his dedication of that book to Princess Diana. I can remember watching her get married to Prince Charles. When was that? I remember they showed it on TV in the U.S. in the middle of the night. Definitely early 80s. Was it 1981? Wow. Where does the time go? Tune in tomorrow. The Book Nook comes your way on Saturday morning at 7 and on Sunday morning at 10:30, and they're completely different programs. Tomorrow, my guest will be Scott Geisel, returning to the show to talk about his new novel, Orca's Call. Some of you are probably familiar with his series set in the Yellow Springs area that features a private investigator named Jackson Flint. Well, this time, Scott takes readers out to the Pacific Northwest, to a really beautiful area, for a mystery and a thriller featuring a couple of characters named Niels and Bly. And I'm not sure if this is going to be a series. I'm sure he's thinking about it. But Orca's Call is a very different book for Scott. And we'll be bringing you Scott Geisel in studio tomorrow morning at 10:30 to talk about it as he revisits the Book Nook And you can listen to the Book Nook anytime you want by going to our Book Nook archive, where we have nearly 1,200 interviews archived at wyso.org. Thanks for listening to your public radio station. Stay tuned.